The following is Jared Spool's keynote, Beyond the UX Tipping Point, from the 2016 UX Immersion Interactions Conference.
I am fully aware that I am the thing between you and drinks. I am even more aware that you are the thing between me and drinks. So let's talk about strategy. And to do that, I want to talk about what is probably the most expensive, most involved UX project that has ever happened. And the really weird thing is that we haven't really talked about it as a group. We don't hear people talking about this. We hear people talking about the Apple Watch, and we hear people talking about all sorts of things, but we're not talking about what turns out, I think, to be one of the most important projects that have happened this decade, and that's the Disney Magic Band. Now, the thing about the Disney Magic Band is it's a wearable. It's like an Apple Watch, but unlike an Apple Watch, it doesn't count your steps, it doesn't measure your heartbeat, it doesn't even tell time, even though it is sold by the same people who make Mickey Mouse watches. And the even more impressive thing about this is that this band cost $1 billion to develop. $1 billion. Put that in perspective, that's about 20 times more than Apple spent on the first iPhone. It's more than twice what Apple spent on the Apple Watch. Disney invested $1 billion in a wearable that doesn't tell time. But what it doesn't do is not the important thing. It's what it does do that's interesting. It has embedded in it three different transmitters. And those transmitters communicate all sorts of information. You see, when you order one of these things, actually, when you order all of these things, because you get them as a group, when you take your family to Disney World or to Disneyland, you put in your order, and a few weeks before you show up at the parks, you get a box, a beautiful box, with the bands labeled for each person. And in fact, the bands are identified on the back for each person, because they are customized to that individual. You configured them when you purchased them, and there's all this information about who you are and what you're doing that's there. And of course, they tell you very specifically in the instructions, this is one of the things they learned through their usability test, was that they had to tell everybody, do not pack this in your suitcase. Because if you pack it in your suitcase and take it to Disney, when you arrive at Disney, they come and they take your suitcases and they bring them up to your room for you. And you have to have the band on, because when you have the band on, you actually get a message on your phone that tells you which room to go to. You don't check in at the hotel. You go straight to your room, and you can use the band to unlock the room as if by magic. Of course, if it was in your suitcase, it would be inside the room. That's not going to work. And you use it to go on the rides at the park, and you use it to pay for everything at the park. And they know where you are. And they know what you're doing. And because you've told them, and it's often the case, they know about the kids. They know who their favorite character is. They know where their birthday is. So if you show up at the park with the magic band on, and it's your kid's birthday, their favorite character will actually hunt them down in the park. And wish them a happy birthday. The reason this cost $1 billion was they had to completely gut the infrastructure of the park to make this happen. The actual wristband itself didn't cost that much to design. It was everything in the park, the entire system, the end-to-end experience that they built. And that's what $1 billion gets you. I mean, it's just magical the way this works, and Disney is all about the magic. Disney's always been about the magic since Walt started it. But they've had this problem for a while, and they sort of slipped away. This isn't the way Disney has thought about technology for the last few decades. In fact, if we go back to 1997, we see a very different Disney. Now, Parks and Resorts is the team that's in charge of the Magic Band. They're the team that's in charge of everything that happens in the parks and resorts. It's appropriately named to that extent. And in 1997, this was the website they put out. And it was horrible. If you tried to book a reservation on this site, there was a very good chance that you'd end up talking to someone at the call center. And in some ways, they didn't see that as a problem, because the people at the call center who finally booked that reservation you tried to book online but couldn't finish, they actually got a commission for it. So they were quite happy to help you. So they had these competing things. The website was trying to book reservations, but it was so poorly made that you ended up calling in. And I gotta tell you, this site was so problematic to use that for the period of 1997 to 2007, we used it as a way to train usability testing, because you could pretty much guarantee that whatever participant you put in front of it would fail at whatever task you gave them to do. So, for example, the canonical task that we used was this one that was basically our benchmark training task. It's called, what is Walt Disney World's least expensive hotel that's on the monorail? And this was actually a real task that we got from a real participant in one of our early studies of the site. We had someone come in who was a real, what they call, worldphile. That's someone who just loves Disney. They go all the time. And they had a six-year-old who was into trains, and particularly into the monorail. And so they wanted to book their next vacation, which happened to be the six-year-old's birthday, at one of the hotels at Walt Disney World that's on the monorail. Now, there are 28 resorts at Walt Disney World, but only three of them are on the monorail. So you have to figure out which one it is. And of the three, two of them are wicked-ass expensive. And one is just normal Disney expensive. So you had to find the one that was normal Disney expensive in the task. And that was the task we would give participants. And this one was a soul crusher. Now, in case you were wondering, you want to try it yourself, the answer is the Polynesian Resort. That is always the one that is just sort of Disney expensive. But for a period of about 12 years, when we had to teach usability testing to a team, we would bring up the Disney site, and we would start to go through this task. And we started to collect statistics, because we actually watched literally hundreds of participants go through this study. And they only had a success rate on this particular task of about 1 in 10. Right? It was truly amazing. But what was even more amazing was a particular failure case that we saw. 1 in 5 participants, 20%, instead of choosing the Polynesian Resort at Disney World, they would pick one of the resorts at Disneyland. Land, world, world, land. What's the difference, right? And we saw this continually through that 12-year period. We kept seeing this particular problem to the point that we would actually put it in our moderator scripts. We had a whole procedure for it just to make sure we understood the problem, right? When we saw someone end up at the hotel in Disneyland and they found the one on the monorail and they'd say, oh, yeah, I guess that's the cheapest one on the monorail at Disneyland, they'd go, okay, I've completed the task. And our moderator would say, congratulations. Just, I have a question, though. Can you ride the monorail from that hotel to Epcot Center. And they'd get this look on their face of, I don't know. And they'd turn back to the computer, and they would click around on links, and they'd look at things, and they would turn back to the moderator, and pretty much every time they'd go, yep. Yep, yes you can. Just in case you needed to know, Disneyland is 3,000 miles from Disney World. That's 3,000 miles in a train that has no restrooms. So I'm standing on a stage somewhere, and I'm telling this story. And after my talk, this person comes up, and on their badge it says, Disney Parks and Resorts. I'm not really sure what's going to happen next. The person says, can I tell you something? You go, yeah. The promise not to tell anyone. Okay. Turns out, it happens all the time. We have people who show up in Orlando with Anaheim reservations. Yeah, you're feeling this, I can tell. Right? In fact, we confirm this. It turns out that they hold a block of rooms, not an insubstantial number of rooms, in Orlando for people who show up with Anaheim reservations. Because why ruin their entire vacation, even when you're sold out, by not having a room for them? So that's amazing, right? And apparently it goes both ways. People are constantly mixing the two up, so they show up in Anaheim with Orlando reservations. So it turns out that on a bookkeeping perspective, it's actually a wash, because every time someone checks into Anaheim, it frees up an Orlando room. They're able to just make it work, right? And this is Disney magic. Now, we knew about this problem for 12 years. I actually don't know how long it went on or if it still goes on. But I do know this. Apparently, it was cheaper to keep a block of rooms reserved than it was to fix the damn website. That's how bad it was at Parks and Resorts. Parks and Resorts was not part of Imagineering. Parks and Resorts is an IT organization. And when they put up that first website, they did what IT organizations do. They said, well, we've got this application that our customer service people use. Why don't we just get one of those designery people, have them make it pretty, and put it up for the customer? Right? That's what they did. And it wasn't a good solution. And it took them a long time to get better. And what I'm really interested in is the fact that they pulled it off. They actually succeeded at getting better. So let's talk about how they did that. And to do that, we have to talk about how we learn stuff. It turns out whenever you need to learn something new, you start at a particular stage, which we call unconscious incompetence. Unconscious incompetence means that you actually don't know what you're doing. You're incompetent. But you also have no idea that you are incompetent. That's the unconscious part, right? So it doesn't matter what you're learning, right? If you're learning UX or you're learning cooking or you're learning a musical instrument, you always start off at this unconscious, incompetent stage. And when you're at this stage, you actually think everything you do is pretty good, because you don't really know the difference between good and bad, right? You don't know that some things are good and some things are bad. As a result, you produce a lot of bad stuff because just probabilistically, that's what's going to happen. And apparently, you don't have any good friends to tell you that that's what you're doing. Right? So you keep cooking or making really awful music or whatever it is for that point. At some point, a friend takes you aside, explains to you that you're actually not good at what you do, and you become aware that there is a difference between good and bad. And that's when you move to the next stage, which is called conscious incompetence. Conscious incompetence is, in fact, what happens when you now know that you are bad at what you do. Now, let's think about this for a second. When we were unconsciously incompetent, we were very happy people. Now that we've become consciously incompetent, that's actually sort of mortifying. And this is, in fact, the stage where lots of people give up, right? Most of us who never learned to draw well used to think we were great at drawing, learned that there was a difference between a good drawing and a bad drawing, and we stopped. Many of us gave up those musical instruments after the first few weeks once we learned how hard they were. It was the exact same thing, right? That's the difference. But for those of us who push on, who get past it, we begin to realize that there are things we can do, there are practices that we can repeat. And those practices basically allow us to get good outcomes. I mean, we follow recipes, we learn our scales, whatever it is, we start to learn the rudiments of what we're doing. Those practices make us better at what we do. And that's when we get to conscious competence. Conscious competence is when we actually now can predictably produce something that's good, as long as we follow the steps, as long as we're paying close attention to what we do. You know, if I follow the recipe, I can make a pretty good mac and cheese. But if I try and improvise, it's not a good mac and cheese. So I stay with the recipe. I keep working on that. And if I keep practicing, if I keep getting better at what I do, then eventually I start to be able to do this unconsciously. I'd be able to learn these practices and I can get these things to happen unconsciously. And that's when I get to unconscious competence. Unconscious competence is that state where I am now capable of doing this without thinking about it, without being able to see the difference. Now, it turns out that these states follow a pattern. Getting from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence is basically becoming literate. When we're learning the difference between good and bad, we are learning the literacy of the thing we are studying. So when we talk about design, we're becoming literate in design. We're becoming aware that colors don't always go together, that a grid makes a difference, that there are certain times you use a checkbox and certain times you use a radio button, that in fact responsive design is an important element. And all of these things that we start to teach ourselves is that literacy. But just because we're literate doesn't mean we can do it. We can read about it, we can learn the terms, we can see the differences, but that doesn't mean we're capable of it. You know, to become capable of it, we have to become fluent. So now we move to fluency. And the thing about fluency is that it's really about being able to make it happen. Right? I can learn a language, I can learn the vocabulary, but that doesn't mean I can go to a country and have a conversation of any meaningful detail with someone until I become fluent. So moving from conscious incompetence to conscious competence is that notion of developing fluency. And when I start to learn how to do things intuitively without consciously thinking about it, that becomes mastery. That's when I've mastered my craft. That's when I've mastered the language. That's when I've mastered the instrument. So when we talk about design, fluency is that ability to be able to do the activities and produce those outcomes. And mastery is the ability to walk into situations and say, aha, even though I've never done this before, I know what to do. Now, here's the thing. I didn't make this scale up. The scale actually came out of the medical profession. Came from Johns Hopkins University because they were interested in answering a completely different question. The question they were interested in answering was, why is it that the world's best surgeons are amazing surgeons but horrible teachers? Why is it that they really don't teach surgery well? Because for years, the way doctors would learn is to go work for the best surgeons. It turns out that's a horrible way to learn. And the reason is that when you are unconsciously competent, it's actually really hard to understand where someone who's consciously incompetent is coming from. You look at the situation and you can clearly see all the signs of what's going wrong. But that consciously incompetent person looks at that situation and they can't see it. They don't know what to do. And people who are really good at their craft turn out to make horrible instructors. The people who are the best instructors are the ones who are at the far right of the conscious competence scale, because they are at least close enough to conscious incompetence that they remember what that was like. So they know how to teach. And this turns out to be really important, because if we're going to get teams and the people we work with to understand the value of design, we have to go through these stages. We have to understand how to move through this space. But this is how it works for an individual. How does it work in an organization? Well, if we want to talk about user experience design, turns out there are stages there too. The first stage is the dark ages, right? It's where no UX design is happening. It's where the business is completely focused on just doing the business things, on producing the technology, on actually just making sure that the business is profitable. And no one's paying attention to design. This is the world of unintentional design. Any design that comes out of that organization has not been given any thought whatsoever. So all those things you look at and you go, how did someone design this? This is probably how, right? They were in this dark ages stage. But what happens here is that there's a moment, and there's an emergent UX leader of some sort. Maybe it's somebody who actually has done this before. Maybe it's someone who just read Steve Krug's book. Who knows, right? But someone comes out and says, hey, we could do something. And they put together a project. And that project actually, compared to what was before it, is decent. It's a good user experience, and it gets noticed. And for a while, the organization goes through another stage, which we call spot UX design, where there are these emergent leaders who keep trying to bring UX into the organization. And they get a little traction. They do version one of whatever this thing is. Maybe they get to version two. But eventually, the organization closes in on them. Everything goes back to the way it was. And that person gets frustrated, and they go work for a company that gets it. And that's really sort of what this stage of spot UX design is about. But then there's another change that happens, another inflection point. And that's when the executives, for some reason, say, you know what, this UX thing, we need to make an investment in this. Maybe it's because there's a competitor that's nipping at their heels that's saying, you know, we have something that's easier to use. Maybe it's because they're going home and they're using their iPads or they're using their phones and they're like, how come our stuff doesn't work like this? I've seen a huge amount of this happening when the iPad first came out because the executives were all walking around with their iPads and then they would bring up their stuff. I'm like, I can't even use our stuff on this thing. Why can't I use this stuff on our thing? And so that was the thing, right? That was the inflection. And suddenly, we get to the next stage where we put together a team and we say, okay, this is the design team, and that team now runs a little service agency inside the organization. And they do their best to help everybody in the organization get to this user experience stuff and get this design stuff. And so that agency comes up and it starts to work. And that starts to kick in. Some teams are good, other teams you have to really push hard. Some people get it, some people don't. But this is beginning to take. And if it takes enough with some teams, those teams will realize the value of having good design. They actually start to get impatient with that internal agency. They start to really feel that that agency isn't giving them everything they can because the agency is servicing the entire organization. And they need dedicated people. And so we reach another inflection point where specific teams are demanding more involvement from design. They want to have dedicated design on their teams. And when we get to that point, what can happen is we start to embed designers into those product and service groups. And they stay in touch and keep in communication with that agency, that centralized group, but now they are actually working with those teams and they are available and they're thinking about those problems day in and day out and they're not switching between one task or another. They are dedicated to that thought. And as that grows, that turns out to work really well. But in a few cases now, we've seen another inflection happen. And that inflection happens when the teams that have these embedded designers are so bought into this process that they cannot get enough out of those designers by themselves. Those designers become a bottleneck. And now they start to take non-designers who are working on those teams, the developers, the product managers, the other people who are involved, and they start to have them know enough about design that they can do the basic stuff. They are now fluent in that design process. And that's what we call infused UX design. And infused UX design is where we get this idea of being design-driven, this idea that we are now thinking about design throughout the organization because everybody has at least fluency in it. And that's the process. Now, Parks and Resorts in 1997 was in the dark ages. But Parks and Resorts in 2014, when the Magic Band came out, that's an infused organization. Everybody gets design. And it took them 17 years to get there. So if you're thinking, we're never going to get there, well, you might be right. But it's a slow process, so it's hard to tell from where you're standing. Now, there's a thing about this, right? Because we've been talking about the organization. But organizations, in fact, are made up of teams. And when we start to look at what happens in an organization that's moving through this scale, we find that different teams are actually moving at different rates. And so at any given time, different teams will be in different spots in the growth stages. Some teams will be really getting it, and they'll have dedicated designers, and they'll be moving forward, and other teams are still in the dark ages, and they're producing crap, and they're not paying attention, and they don't know the difference. And when we start to look at those teams, what we see is, in fact, they are made of people. Eventually, it always becomes Soylent Green. But the thing about them being made of people is that they're not just any people. They're people who have influence. And that turns out to be really important. Because influencers have different behaviors at different stages. And so if we understand where our influencers are on a given team, we can understand why the team is able to move forward or not. If you have a strong influencer who is basically in the dark ages and just says, look, I don't know what this design stuff is, let's just keep moving and get stuff out, that's a problem. That's going to hold the entire team back. That's going to cause those folks who are at the front to say, our folks don't get it, how do we convince them? And we've been playing this how do we convince them game for a long time, but that's because we've been thinking about it wrong. The influencers are at different stages, which means that a team is actually held back because of the most immature influencer. And it's not a matter of selling them on the idea, it's a matter of literacy and fluency and mastery. The issue here isn't that they need to be convinced, the issue is they need to actually have the understanding of design. And what we need to do is, through our work, actually get them to level up. And if you want to understand what a UX leader does, that's it. They are leveling up everybody on the team. And when everybody on the team is leveled up, that team produces better work. And when more teams produce better work, we get better outcomes. So for the last few years, there's been this interesting mystery that I've been trying to get to the bottom of. And the mystery has to do with a thermostat. This was the round thermostat. That's what its brand name was called, the round thermostat that was produced in 1953. It was designed by a designer named Henry Dreyfuss, who probably is the first real user experience designer around. And he created this basically canonical design that became the mainstay of the industry. And Honeywell sold millions of these things. In 2011, the Nest came out. And the mystery is, why didn't Honeywell come out with the Nest? Why was it that it was Tony Fadell and his team that pulled that off, and not the team that owned that market, that made billions of dollars on those thermostats? How come Honeywell didn't create the Nest? And to get to that, we have to look at one more progression of stages. One more progression of growth. And that's how the market works. Now, when any new thing comes out, the market gets infatuated by the technology of it. The first cell phone was the Motorola Dynatac 800. This device cost $2,500. It weighed 4 pounds, and it barely worked. But people would pay for it, and it was incredible. People would pay that kind of money for a cell phone. It was crazy. And then an inflection point happened. In this case, there was a competitor. And once there's a competitor, the market shifts to one that talks about features. And when you're in the feature phase, it's all about what those things can do. And everybody's sort of talking about this feature versus that feature. Initially, it has to just do with the quantity of features. Eventually, it has to do with the best features. And you can tell you're in this stage because every ad for every product that are competing against each other has these checkboxes, right? It has columns with the different competitors and rows with the different features, and under our product it says yes, 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 and under their product says no, 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 yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, right? And our goal is to get as many features into the product as we can. But there's another inflection point, and that inflection point happens when the market, the people who are deciding which product they buy, stop caring about features. At some point, you cannot put any more features in a product that anybody cares about. So you just start creating stupid features just to get people's attention. This is how we got the paperclip. Right? We just keep putting stupid things in. Come to think of it, it's probably why we have Chatbox and Messenger now. We just have to put the stupid things in. And at this point, we enter a new stage of the market, a stage that's focused on experience. And this is when someone who is often an outsider to the competitors, not the leading competitor, comes in and actually makes a difference, actually starts to change things. And this is a fascinating period, right? Because suddenly we can talk about the user experience. And this is where we shine. We do fantastic. None of us like working in that feature stage, and we don't even get employed in the technology stage. It's the experience stage where we get valuable to folks because we're going to pull this off. But interestingly enough, we don't get valuable from the market leaders because the market leaders are so in that feature mindset that they can't get out of their head, that there's something else that could be better. Even if they could get out of their head, the problem is they've got a sales force out there that is telling people, you need the features, you need the features, you need the features. And to then one day say, actually, all those features we told you about yesterday, you don't need any of them. Right? That goes away. When the iPhone first came out, it had fewer features than the Nokia N95, which came out 6 months before, which the N95 was all about the amazing camera and all about video and all about music. This thing had no ability to send pictures. It had no ability to do video. And yet, it cost 3 times as much. And everybody thought they were nuts. Turns out there's another inflection point. And that inflection point happens when the product becomes part of a bigger experience. The phone, interestingly enough, is hardly about making calls. Every time I get a phone call on my phone, I look at it as if, what the hell is it doing that for? Oh yeah, that's the phone. I'm supposed to answer this now. Right? Everything becomes part of this bigger thing. I was reminded of this recently. We get to this stage, I call it the commodity stage. And I was reminded of this recently when I read a headline in the paper that talked about how American Airlines was suing Gogo InFlight. They were suing Gogo InFlight because the contract that American had signed with Gogo InFlight 5 years ago for a 10-year contract for Wi-Fi on airplanes, they wanted to get out of. And the reason they wanted to get out of this contract is that Gogo's service, the speed of the connection, the ability to handle a plane full of customers, the price of that service, was making American Airlines look bad. People were complaining to American that the Wi-Fi sucked. So American wanted to go to one of their competitors, because it turns out now there's 5 or 6 other companies that actually have lower priced, better service in plain Wi-Fi. But the 10-year contract would not let them out. Gogo would not let them out of their contract. So they decided to sue to get out of their contract, sort of like someone saying, I want to move, I don't want to live here anymore because, I don't know, I guess there's mice, right? Same deal. And they just got into a contract they thought that 10 years was going to be enough time when they signed it, but turns out the technology's been moving too fast. And here's the thing. Gogo did what they promised to do. It's just it's not good enough to be on an airplane anymore with that quality of service. And they were making the bigger airplane experience worse. And this is what happens, right? Suddenly, we are looking at our devices, we're looking at our things, and we are now moving in a direction where that thing that we built, that one piece of technology, it does what we promised it would do, but it actually doesn't fit in the bigger experience, that end-to-end thing. This commodity stage, this is where service design happens. Because we are no longer focused on that little thing, we are focused on the bigger picture, the bigger journey that those users and customers are having. And that service design element is key. All of user experience will be service design in a very short period of time because this stage keeps happening. Where service design will be all of UX. I mean, they're interchangeable. So, these four stages turn out to be very important, particularly when we map them against the stages of how we get better, how we become more design-driven. Because what we've seen is that if we truly want to compete in those experience and commodity stages, our organizations have to get to that infused design point, where it's almost impossible to remain a viable competitor if you don't get to that last stage. But how does this answer the Honeywell dilemma? Well, we can see the progression. Honeywell started as a technology play. Then, the last decade or so, they got into programmable thermostats, but they never made it to where the nest was. They sort of stopped at the feature wars, just like people often do. And an outside competitor came in, Nest, and took over. And that's intriguing, because that change to a new player, they came in at a later stage. And if we look at sort of what happens here, what we see is that there's basically this interesting phenomena of Honeywell being at spot design and the Nest being at infused design. How did the Nest get there so fast? Well, it's sort of the way startups work. A startup can actually choose where it goes. Now, originally, when we were putting this theory together, we thought, well, maybe startups were sort of like stem cells. Right? Stem cells are these magical cells in the body that can be anything. And when they're a stem cell, they really aren't anything. But at some point, the stem cell decides what it wants to be, and then it becomes a liver cell or a colon cell. And then it's a colon cell forever. And startups are sort of like that, you know. I've definitely met startups that I think of as colon cells. And the thing about the startups is that they are, in fact, these things that can be wherever they want to be. But it turns out it's not quite that. What Tony Fadell did at Nest was he hired a whole bunch of ex-iPod and iPhone people, he being the designer of the original iPod and having worked on the original iPhone. So he brought a whole bunch of those people with them, and they were already design infused. So that when they showed up, they actually were in a situation where they didn't have to deal with an existing company team that would hold them back. And this is why Honeywell could not pull this off. Honeywell would have to get rid of everybody who was less mature than this new startup thing they were building. And you see companies try this, right? They go off and they create this little startup thing, or maybe they acquire a startup thing, or maybe they start some sort of incubator thing, and they're trying to do this. But their existing immature organization holds them back, and that is the problem. That the issue here is that startups live in this little vacuum where if they hire the team just right, they can be way down the infused stages and not be held back. But interestingly enough, they have to keep that up. And often what happens as they grow, they lose that ability to hire those great people. They start to bring in people from other companies who are less mature, and suddenly those wonderful startups just become just like everybody else. And now they are back where they need to be. And the thing is that where we're at here is at these stages where we need to really think about what we want to do. Now, there's something magical about that infused UX design stage. There's another point of inflection that happens. Before we get to that point of inflection, the organization sets its bar such that it will only ship a product or service if it technically works and if it meets the business needs. But if it's not designed well, we'll still ship it. It's okay. We'll get it in the next release. And if not that release, it'll be the release after. Right? There's an old saying that Microsoft products never get good to version 3. It's because Microsoft basically has this as their way of doing business. Has to work technically, has to meet the business need, but the design, the user experience, we'll fix it. We'll get there. But an infused UX design organization, if it pushes hard enough, will get to something that we call the UX tipping point. And the UX tipping point is when, yes, it still has to work technically, yes, it still has to meet business needs, but it also has to be delightfully designed. And that's the key, being able to be at that point where they are able to be delightfully designed. And the interesting thing about that is that we can look at an organization and we can say, that's a goal. That's something we can strive for. This is the thing to look at. That moment, that point where products are held back because they aren't designed right. The Magic Band was exactly that. It was actually 2.5 years late. And it was 2.5 years late, not because it technically didn't work, not because it didn't do all the business things they needed to do, but because the user experience wasn't right. The Disney cast members have a saying. The saying is, what would Walt want us to do? And Walt would hold back a product if it didn't have a great experience. And the Magic Band team did just that. Raising the cost, huge. Creating risk, huge. They were so afraid that Universal was going to find out they were working on this and come out with some cheap knockoff and get there first so that when they finally came out with that thing, it looked like they were just a Me Too product. They were so afraid that Six Flags was going to beat them to it. The secrecy around this project was crazy. But they got there. And it was amazing. My friend Dan Moll likes to talk about the difference between this. This is Newton's pendulum, right? You've seen this before, where basically it just, you know, goes back and forth and back and forth. And he refers to this as a process, right? There's really only one way to do it. You set it up, it just goes back and forth, and it's really not that interesting. You watch it for a little while, it's mesmerizing, but after a while it just gets dull. But if you compare that to a soccer field, what we see here is a system. Dan says, you know, this is filled with rules and constraints. But what happens when you put people inside those constraints, that's fascinating, that's interesting, that's fun. And so systems are way more interesting than processes. They're way more creative, they're way more fun to work within, and the results are much better. And so if we want to get to being these organizations, if we want to do what Disney did, we have to figure out what's the system that we want to build. And you can think of the system as being this place where you put down the rules, you put down the constraints, but then you give people a set of plays. And you have them execute those plays. And that's basically how sports works. And so what are the plays that we can use to become design-driven? Well, we started to study this, and we've actually come up with a list of about 100 plays. And there are things like getting people started with usability testing and talking about design, and they go all the way to doing critique and putting out a living design system and then moving forward and starting to use metrics more effectively and analytics and all these things. Each one of these is a play. And we started to ask the question, well, what are the plays that make the biggest difference? We looked at a bunch of organizations that have really sort of pushed the limits on this infused design thing. And we said, okay, who's getting there? Who's becoming design-driven? What are the plays that are getting there? And we found out that there were basically three plays that drove all these organizations that were working really well. The first one is immersive exposure. And immersive exposure is what happens when we get folks into the field. We get them to see the users. We get them exposed to what users actually do. And that exposure is key. And it's a literacy play. You can use this for teams that are not very literate. You can use this for influencers that don't understand design. But instead of explaining to them the value of design, the simplest thing to do is to get them exposed to actual users using the design. This is why usability tests work so well, right? We get these influencers to see what users are there. And yeah, sometimes you have to bring them videotapes and cut out all the boring parts of the test and just show them that. But if you really want to be immersive, what you need to do is get them in the field. You need to bring them out and actually have them see the users work. See them use the tool. See them deal with the situations. When you do that, it's a radical experience. I'm betting that many of you have shown somebody real users doing real stuff, and the reaction you get is, why didn't we do this 2 years ago? It's just crazy how much this works. And so we found that the organizations that are best at this, they're investing a minimum of 2 hours every 6 weeks. And that's the minimum. The better organizations are investing way more. They're getting people immersed on a regular, you know, three-week basis for a full day. I mean, it's crazy the amount of time people are spending seeing users actually use their designs or a competitor's designs. And the benefits are huge. Now, the process of doing this allows you to get an understanding of what's happening to that customer, to that user. And we can map this on a journey map. Now, lots of different ways to do journey maps, but the way I like to do it is you take the things that a user needs to do. In this case, we're having them book a property. And you measure it on a scale of frustration to delight. And you say, okay, that first step where they were searching for the hotel, that was really great. But once they got to the hotel and they started to look at the different rooms that were available, man, that was frustrating. They couldn't figure out what was different between one or the other. And then you say, okay, but they decide to pick one and they start booking, that works. But then they get into the payment engine and the payment engine is asking them to take the dashes out of their phone number and it's asking them to put in the security number on their card multiple times, and that's really frustrating. And finally they say, okay. Right? And that experience is amazing. And you get an influencer to see this happen, and the first thing they say is, we got to fix that. We got to look at these points on our design. We got to make them better. My favorite thing to do, I have two little tricks that I do with this. The first one is, before we actually get to where the customer is, often when we're driving in the car, when we're at the meeting place for our sort of pre-gathering before we all march in and visit to this user, I ask people, I share with them what I know about the participant in the study. Say, here's what we know. This is a person who uses our product all the time, and they use it for these things, and they work at an organization that's given us this much money to buy these extensions, and we're going to hopefully today see them use this thing. And then I ask, what do you think their journey is going to be like? What do you think the steps they'll go through are? What do you think the frustrating parts and the delightful parts will be? And I have everybody who's on that little away team tell me what those frustrating or delightful parts are. And often what happens is they get really excited about, oh, I think this person's going to be like one of our best users because they use it all the time and they're big on this and they're going to be there. And then we get to their office and we see it and it never works out that way. It's a dismal period. And here's the thing, right? There's two outcomes that happen. Either they predicted correct, at which point whoever that is like, hey, I'm good. And I'm like, hey, you actually sort of know something about customers. I'm going to keep talking to you. Or they get it completely wrong. But they know they got it completely wrong. One of the things, before I started doing this, one of the things I noticed is we would take people out and they'd sit through this experience and they'd watch these people suffer and have all these frustrating moments, and they go, yeah, I sort of expected that. Sort of expected is not expected. Sort of expected means I didn't really think about it before now. So I make them think about it, and that does it. The other thing I do is whoever the most highest paid person in the room is, they're the ones who draw the map. That's their job. Hey, I'm too busy. I'm going to be talking to the person. I really need to concentrate on the interview and the session. Could you actually draw this for me? Write down each step and then write down whether they're frustrated or delighted as we go? Yeah, sure. How hard can that be? Okay. They're the ones who are putting those points at the bottom of the scale. So that's immersive exposure. Getting folks to see it. And it changes the way things work. Dana Chisnell, who is part of the U.S. Digital Service, she talks about how she's been using immersive exposure by getting developers and product managers out into the field to actually see government employees use the systems that they're building. And what she's learned is that every time she does that, those developers and those product managers come back, and the way they create user stories, the way they create use cases, the way they think about the design changes completely. And it doesn't take more than a day's worth of visit to see that outcome. So this turns out to be really powerful. The second play is a shared experience vision. And a shared experience vision is going and showing where we want to go. What is the experience we want the user to have? And this is really a fluency play. But you can, if you've got a lot of people who are fluent, you can use it alongside the folks who are still becoming more literate as to talk about where you're trying to get to. And the way to think about this is this is the experience. This isn't the actual screens of what you're going to do. This is the story of what that user's experience is like. What is that journey going to be like? And the way to think of this is it's basically a flag that's in the sand on the horizon. And it's too far for us to get to today or tomorrow. Maybe it's going to take us 5 years to get there. But because we can clearly see the flag, we know which direction to go in. We know it's not that direction, it's that direction. So we can start taking baby steps to get there. And it doesn't matter where anybody is in the organization. If everybody can clearly see the flag, the rule is march towards the flag. That's the only rule you need. And the really neat thing is it's in the sand, which means if market conditions change, if the various elements change, you pick it up and you put it someplace else. And as long as everybody can clearly see it, the rule doesn't change. March towards the flag. And you can get to that vision pretty simply. You get to the vision with the journey map, right? Because what you say is, okay, we've got these frustrating bits. What happens if we made the whole thing delightful? What would the experience be like if it was delightful all the way across? If we know exactly what the frustrating bits are, what if we removed them all and everything was a delight? How would it be a different experience for that person? That's where you start. You put that flag in the sand on the horizon. We use a question to figure out how well organizations have one of these. It's a simple question. We just go up to everybody and we say, 5 years from now, what will it be like to use your product or service? What would it be like? What's the experience of a customer 5 years from now? And we pick the 5-year date because we are interested in getting past the legacy constraints, right? If you just said, well, a year from now, what will it be like? It's like, well, it won't be a whole lot different because we're never going to get rid of that mainframe, right? But 5 years, yeah, we could get rid of that existing technology. We could get rid of those existing business rules. We could make this work. So what is that 5-year thing? And we don't go out 10 years because 10 years we're now in jetpacks and flying cars. So 5 years, you know, if you think about what technology was 5 years ago, it wasn't a whole lot different than now, except we use our phones a lot more. Okay, I get that, right? But 5 years ago, we were on the iPhone 3. It wasn't that different than it is today. So we can sort of extrapolate 5 years from now. We'll be on the 7SC. And so, you know, what is that 5-year vision look like? And teams can start to think about that. And they can say, okay, this is what that experience is like. You stick that flag in the sand. And then as you learn more, you move the flag around. But as long as everybody can clearly see it, you've got your shared experience vision. The last play is a culture of continuous learning. Now, culture is basically something that we keep telling ourselves until we actually do it, right? It's what we say we're going to do, and we keep repeating it until we actually work that way. And so the culture is how we perceive we work. It's that idea of what we're doing. And a culture of continuous learning is a way to constantly ensure that we're trying to get better than we are. And this turns out to be a play we use in all the stages, whether it's literacy, fluency, or mastery. It basically is about understanding who our customers are, understanding what our organization is. It's the stuff that Mark was talking about earlier in terms of having those conversations and getting to that sort of rich place. Now, there's a culture out there that people try and do. It's this culture of fail fast, right? The problem with the fail fast culture is that nobody is comfortable answering the question, why did we fail? But what we've learned is that people are really good at answering the question, what did we learn? And if you ask that question frequently enough, you develop a culture of learning where people are constantly talking about this. Mark talked earlier about reflection, taking that time to just stop and think about what is it that we just did. That's part of learning. Having those reflection moments is key. Some of you may know that I'm involved in a school called Center Center. It's a school to create UX designers, which we're hoping to open this fall. And we have built reflection into the process. Every day, the students will take that time to reflect on what they've done. But we've even done this in the way we've built the school. We, as a team, have daily stand-ups. And like most organizations, our daily stand-ups have the usual cadre of questions. What did we get done since the last stand-up? What are we planning to get done before the next stand-up? What's preventing us from getting the stuff on our list done? What's the most important thing on our list? Because it turns out when you share that, people discover that the thing I thought you were working on is not the thing you think is most important, and I now wonder why that is. These are common stand-up questions. Most teams use some variation of this. But we added a question. We actually call it our number five. And number five is, what's the most important thing you've learned since the last stand-up, and how will it change what you do in the future? And every day, you have to bring a number five to the meeting. And what's fascinating is that this is the most interesting part of the stand-up. Hearing people's number fives is fascinating and educational. And sometimes I learn things I didn't know. And sometimes I learn that I'm only slightly ahead of someone else, because I just learned that a little while ago. And it's really brilliant. But what's incredible about this is that we've developed a culture of learning where every day we get to say that we didn't know something until yesterday, and it's going to change the way we work. So that we're not embarrassed to admit we didn't know something. We actually are proud to admit it. The most embarrassing thing is when you can't think of a number five. And I've learned that everybody on the staff keeps a little journal of things that they've learned that they haven't told anybody yet, so that when they have a day when they can't think of their number five, they can say, oh, there's that. That was like my number five a couple weeks ago. And so this is incredible when you start doing this. You actually develop this culture of learning. And it's these three things that Disney did. The team that was building the Magic Band spent tremendous amounts of time in the park. They built in a soundstage behind what was the MGM Studios, it's now the Hollywood Studios Park. They built in a soundstage there an exact replica of what the entire Magic Band experience would be like. And at first, it was just complete cardboard and foam core, and when you would take your plastic Magic Band that didn't actually do anything and you held it up to the thing, somebody would go, boop, boop. And you would go through, and every point of contact for that thing had a mock-up in that sound studio. And they were able to see what it was like, and they were able to bring people from the park and experiment and test things. And that immersive exposure was key. But more importantly, they got the executives. All of the executives, the board of Disney, had multiple meetings in that sound studio. They got to see what that was like. Because after all, they were approving a $1 billion investment. They saw what that future was about. That studio also represented the shared experience. And as that experience changed, they updated the studio. Everybody knew what was happening in that soundstage. And they knew what was shifting. And that was the place where the decisions were made that said, that's not good enough. We need to do it better. And that soundstage, they kept all of their old prototypes, so they have a history of the evolution of learning. And having that room, that space, that place where you can see how you got there. So many times we present our final work and we don't tell people the evolution of how we got there, and then they start making suggestions of things we've already done and we get pissed at them. Right? Because they're not part of the culture of continual learning. They haven't been brought in that journey. This is what Disney did. And because Disney did this, when your seven-year-old holds up their band to get into the park, and it's their birthday, that little meter makes a special noise. And the entire Disney cast, the 10 or 15 people that are standing around that entrance gate, turn to your seven-year-old and say, "Happy birthday." That's magic. That's what happens when you go past the UX tipping point. So, we've got to take teams from unconscious incompetence through to conscious competence or even unconscious competence. We have to think in terms of literacy, fluency, and mastery to get there. Design is no longer about putting pixels on the screen. Design is about how do we get everybody around us to understand that evolution. And by having these frameworks of these stages, we now can understand why organizations struggle, and we now know what to do. And the plays that we've created, which are really good, they help us, and we can put together the playbooks that actually get us to that design-driven organization. And this is really exciting for me because we've put together a workshop, a day-and-a-half workshop that actually talks about this whole experience. It talks about how an organization gets through those stages, and we take that apart, and we tailor plays specific for each person in the workshop to say, okay, where's your organization at? Where are the teams at? Where are the individuals at? What are the plays that are going to work? We look at product strategy and delivery, and we look at the teams we're building, and specific plays around how do we get the designers in our organization leveled up, and how do we get the non-designers leveled up, and how do we hire new talent so that they come in at the right stage instead of coming in too immature and thereby setting us back. And so this is an exciting sort of direction for where we're going at UIE because it is key. And what's beautiful is that we can merge what we're doing with Center-Center so the students we're producing at the school are going to come out and be ready to tackle these organizational challenges. So the whole thing fits together, and I just get very excited. If for some reason you found any of this the least bit interesting, of course you can find out more stuff about this on UIE.com. We're going to be producing a whole bunch of podcasts and articles on the plays and how they work and how to put together the playbook. That's coming out in the next few months, so look for that there. Of course, if you work in design and for some reason we're not connected on LinkedIn, please connect to me on LinkedIn. You can use this email address to do it. LinkedIn turns out to be a great way for me to get in touch. I know many of you I'm connected to, and we've had great conversations on LinkedIn. Please come do that. And finally, you can follow me on the Twitters, at JM Spool, where I tweet about design, design strategy, design education, and the amazing customer service patterns of the airline industry. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for drinks. Thank you.
For more information and videos from the UX Immersion Interactions Conference, visit our All You Can Learn library at aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.